Across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet, by webcast and by podcast, my name is Howard Hughes and this is The Unexplained. Thank you very much for keeping faith with the show, and also thank you for your recent emails. Great ones, good guest suggestions, and some very good comments from every corner of our globe. A lot of you pointing out some problems we're having at the moment with iTunes. The last couple of shows have not appeared on iTunes. We have been putting them there, and for some reason they have been disappearing. So if you would also like to put some pressure on iTunes and try, as we're trying, to get them to fix that problem, hopefully we'll get somewhere. Thank you to David for your email. Mark Doyle, who is a big fan of Gregory Sams and the last show we did, and Mark Doyle said that just like Gregory Sams, he's discovered that when he eats food that's been packed full of chemicals and testosterone and all kinds of stuff, meat I'm talking about, it can have an adverse effect on his mood, which is something that Gregory Sams talked about. I had a very intriguing email from a member of the emergency services here who told me about the spectacular coincidences surrounding some of his 911 or 999 call-outs here. And he says sometimes you find that the right people appear in the right place at the right time. For example, you might have a guy knocked off his bike, and walking past at that time might just be a doctor. He says, that kind of thing, those kind of coincidences seemingly happen all the time. Mark Williams, thank you for your email. I'm on it. Elizabeth in Estonia. Elizabeth, thank you for your email. Very concerned about you. Please visit your doctor. There isn't a doctor in this world who will not listen to you about this, okay? Nick wants to put a link on his website to mine. Not a problem, Nick. Mark suggesting Elder George as a guest. Mark, if you can tell me more, I'd be very grateful. Carl suggesting Michael Tellinger. Carl, we've had him on twice, but at the moment he's launching his own political party in South Africa, isn't he? The Ubuntu Party. So maybe we'll get him on again. Colin in Birmingham, UK, with a story about the M6 motorway and some weird stuff that happened there, a highway here in the United Kingdom. Colin, if you can give me some more details, perhaps we can get you on the show. Peter in Christchurch, New Zealand, my good wishes and good thoughts to you, Peter, and for all that you've been through in this last year or two. You have my complete sympathy, and please keep on keeping on, and I'm thinking of you, but you've been through both of the earthquakes that happened in Christchurch, and you've come through it, and, you know, I am thinking about you. Celia wants to know more about the Philadelphia experiment. Stephen Ramirez in Chicago, some thoughts about Robert Bavall from Stephen. Thank you for those. Stephen Myers, if you can tell me more about yourself, maybe we can take your idea further. Tim in Madeira Beach, Florida, thank you for your email from that lovely place. And also Jean, thank you for your email. And that's just a few of the emails that I've had in during the last week or so. So thank you very much for those. www.theunexplained.tv is the place to go if you want to react with this show. Thank you, as I say, to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for his terrific work getting the show out to you. Haven't got a lot of time, so let's get right now to our guest, Linda Moulton Howe, American investigative researcher, the best in the business as far as I'm concerned, and she's got some amazing new findings. So let's cross to Albuquerque and say, Linda, it's a great privilege and pleasure once again to have you on The Unexplained.
Well, thank you, Howard. I'm glad that I am back, and I'm grateful to you that you're one of the few people on the planet who are trying to bring some intelligence and pressure of fact to Earth mysteries that we all should be paying attention to.
We should, and the problem here is that we don't. Partly, and I have to say this as somebody like you who've been involved in the media for years, partly because of the way these things are treated by the media. I don't know whether you followed the story, and this is just before we get into conversation, Linda, but a week or so ago here in the UK as I record this, we had a great big to-do, as they say here, about big cat sightings in one part of the UK. And the police even were convinced that maybe there was something in this. And then later, of course, we got a statement saying probably there wasn't anything in this, but be vigilant anyway. Problem is that I think a lot of the media treated that as one big joke story, and they always do. And that's why we don't get further than we do with these things.
And Howard, when you look at why the media does what it does, and that is knee-jerk reaction with satire and ridicule to subjects that range from UFOs and crop circles to cat sightings and Bigfoot and so forth, you have to go back to World War II and what happened between England and the United States, and I think Prime Minister Winston Churchill and then General Dwight D. Eisenhower. This goes to something that was released a few months ago, or maybe it was a year now, by the Ministry of Defense in England in your so-called UFO files release, that a son who is a scientist in Great Britain wrote to the Ministry of Defense a letter about his father being a security guard to Prime Minister Churchill. And I believe he said the year was somewhere around 1943. That would have been 2 years before the end of the war. And that the father had told the son, that's what this letter was about, that Prime Minister Churchill and Dwight D. Eisenhower were overheard by the security guard father to the letter writer talking about a UFO, an unidentified aerial craft or unidentified aerial vehicle that had run rings around one of the RAF planes at some place in Europe, and that the father security guard overheard Churchill say to Dwight D. Eisenhower, "You know that we must keep this a secret for at least 50 years to prevent," and it was the normal list of religions falling and economies falling and society falling apart.
And all the stuff and that we've been hearing for decades.
Exactly. And if that is where the germinal seed of these policies of denial, suppression, and lies in England, the United States, and other places began, it is exactly the same counterintelligence minds that were operating in England and the and for the United States in World War II. Some of the best brains on the planet were in intelligence and counterintelligence. And they are the ones that would then have carried forward policies of denial that included that what happened in Roswell were weather balloons, that what happened in Michigan was swamp gas, so-called preposterous now Pentagon release a film showing somebody throwing up a hubcap in the air and taking then a photograph of it and saying, this is what UFOs are about. This was a deliberate planned counterintelligence operation to make sure that the public and the media would stay away from the unidentified aerial craft phenomena as long as the policy of denial was there. And we are now in 2012, September, when the truth is that from World War II to this very day, nothing has changed in those policies of denial about something so fundamental that I personally think belongs to the entire human family.
So, Linda, do you believe that there is...
Well, but let me just finish.
You talked about a policy.
The fact is we are not alone in this universe. We have never been alone. And this is what the governments, your country and my country, have been trying to keep from the public and the media, and that's why you get this satire when something like one of these black cat sightings occurs and the media automatically uses it to laugh at on the news.
So you think that there's a policy that, as you say, has lasted for decades and decades and decades, and that has fathered, certainly in this country, maybe to an extent in your own country, a culture of rubbishing stories like this because the overall ethos is one of denial.
Yes, because the government set that in motion, and they are very good at that. And right now, there's not many of us on the planet who have been working for a long time to bring the pressure of facts to bear on substantial Earth mysteries that when you do begin digging, and you do go to eyewitnesses, and sometimes you go to forensic experts, for example, all the work that I have done in various fields in this country and other places on the animal mutilation phenomena, and you are actually looking at what is happening to tissue and fluids and soil and plants and the ground, and anybody who takes the time and the money to do that, when they are dealing with a bloodless, trackless animal mutilation, what they find on the other end of research are enough anomalies, and I've reported, it seems to me, hundreds of them, But what you then find is I am an Emmy Award-winning, Peabody Award-winning, Ohio State Award-winning. I have a long list of journalistic awards and have considered myself always to be in mainstream media. But because I chose to investigate animal mutilations that led to the human abduction syndrome, that led into a whole series of mysteries that seem to be related to the presence of some sort of non-human intelligence on this planet, that you find that then there is a pressure of marginalizing any person who tries to actually go after evidence and report it.
Do you feel marginalized? Do you yourself feel marginalized, Linda?
There's been efforts to marginalize, but I think that what has worked in my favor has been that I never, ever tried to go off of the strict journalistic path of going after the multiple eyewitnesses and letting them speak for themselves and then combine it with going for forensic evidence.
But that's the difference between you and a lot of other journalists and people who write books these days. You know, we talk to an awful lot of people who write books based on third-party accounts. You are one of the few people who actually believes in what I was always taught when I was at university studying journalism, and that is go to primary sources if you can.
Exactly, and use the New York Times and the Washington Post and the London Times rule. You always try for three if you can get them. And sometimes I'm in the position where I can talk with six people, and only one will give me permission to talk with them on the record with their real name. And sometimes even of six people that you have a really well-fleshed-out story, that person might not even give you permission to use their name. And that is always a challenge to any reporter worth their salt, because your strongest story is when you have the name and the rank and the title and the location of the person that you are interviewing, and that's what you're always trying to report.
It's what we call standing up the story. When you get into the situation, you've got loads of experience doing this. When you get into a situation where somebody tells you a great story, which many people have over the years, and they say, by the way, please don't use my name and don't attribute this to me, what weapons do you have in your armory to use to persuade them to please go on the record for everybody's sake?
Sometimes I have appealed to people, depending upon the seriousness of the story, that if they will use their name and I can support it as a reporter, as a story with documents that I have and that in some cases cannot show, but I can say that I have, and that they use their name, other people who have, and usually these are military and government sources, other people will come forward even if I cannot use them on the record. And that has happened a few times where somebody has said, okay, I'll do this, I'll go on the record. But what I have consistently found and still feel it is very legitimate journalism, if I say I will call you John Smith or Jane Doe, but you have to send me your DD-214. You need to send me any articles of discharge. I need photographs. I need information about where you went to school, your high school, where you did military training. And I will have a file of documents that people send me, even in some cases where they will not say, yes, you have my permission to show this with blanking out Social Security numbers or relevant personal data. So at least I have been able to feel confident that I have files that back up people that I have put on the air as John Smith in really difficult subjects. For example, right now, I'm dealing with what started out as, I thought, a fascinating mystery, not knowing, really, do I have enough here to substantiate it? But I'm going to go with the interview with Doug Mutchler a couple of months ago, who had emailed me after I had returned from Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, in my own research of that amazing place that has been carbon dated at 12,000 years old. And then 1,000 years after it had been constructed, which is amazing, and we can talk about later in the program, 1,000 years later, it was buried. And there are other buried sites of archaeological note around this planet. And when this Doug Mutchler heard me doing reports at Earth Files and on Coast to Coast AM radio about this amazing hilltop site covering 30 acres that had been completely buried over in ways still undetermined, it sparked in his mind what he said when he contacted me, that when he was working in Army counterintelligence in Anchorage, Alaska, at Fort Richardson, that in either the last week of November or the first week of December of 1992, he and 39 other guys, a total of 40, were in an orderly room where there was a television set on base at Fort Richardson in Alaska, and they watched with their mouths open as a program described the discovery of a large pyramid, larger than Cheops in Egypt, underground, literally fully under the surface of the earth in Alaska, and that its discovery had been tied to the Lop Nor, China, underground May 22nd, 1992, underground nuclear test of 1 megaton. So that was in May, the end of May, and he's talking about the end of November or first of December, so it was about 5 months. Mm-hmm. Since the China test and this program on the air, which would make sense if scientists were studying the crust of the earth and using the detonation in China, which was a large detonation at the time, to study the crust, and they had discovered this pyramid, and that's what the story was.
And what is this thing in Alaska, which is much remarked upon on your website at the moment? What is it, do we think?
I'm describing the seed of how this story started. Mm. So Doug Mutchler had contacted me. I had done an interview, and he had said very straightforwardly, I would like to know if any of those other men in the orderly room are out there and remember this and could get in touch with you, because he said this is what happened. The very next day, I contacted by phone the Anchorage Channel 13 and said I wanted to get a videotape of that news story the night before about the pyramid being discovered in Alaska, because I was based there and I wanted to know more about it. And they said that they couldn't discuss it on the phone, and I went down and I met, he said, specifically with the general manager of the TV station, who said that there must have been some misunderstanding, that Channel 13 had not broadcast anything about a discovered underground pyramid the night before.
Wow.
And when Doug Mutchler said to the general manager, but there are 39 other guys and me, and we heard it last night, that's why I made this trip down here, the general manager said, you're mistaken, we did not broadcast anything, and this guy with counter-intel experience for 13 years in the Army said, I'm being lied to, there's a cover-up here, there's somebody who doesn't want people to follow this up. So he's leaving the station, and a engineer tech, some tech that he had seen in a studio where he had gone to meet the general manager, came over to where he was leaving, whispered in his right ear, you're right, we did broadcast it, but I can't help you. We've been ordered to destroy the tape.
That's amazing on all kinds of levels when you think that we associate that kind of cover-up with Roswell, if it happened then. People would be very surprised that it could happen more recently.
Well, absolutely. And this is the what's called the MO, the operating modus operandi of the way governments operate with media, behind the scenes. And usually there is not a person in Army counterintelligence who confronts a TV manager of a station and gets such a response, but nevertheless, behind the scenes, a lot of us know that there are all kinds of strings that can be pulled by the Department of Defense in the United States about the so-called major media, and can block stories, stop stories, divert stories, and this, I believe, happened. Now, that went out on Coast to Coast AM here. In a week's time, that program on repeats reaches about 5 million or so people. And I had put out an appeal for anybody who might have any other information about the discovery of this underground pyramid in Alaska to get in touch with me. Well, I started getting some of the most amazing emails of my career from people who said, you can't use my name, I will not do an interview, but here is what I know about. And one of those was a man describing his father as having worked for Western Electric, which was associated with the Bell system, back in the late 40s going into the 50s, and that his father had worked on an underground pyramid in the years 59 to 61 in Alaska and gave me a whole bunch of details. Excuse me. And I called him and asked if he would talk with me on the record and who would I be able to use his father's real name. He sent me, at my request, he sent me all kinds of information about his father with his father's real name in the Western Electric badge, in the Navy discharge papers, in his Pioneers of America pin, which the only people who could ever have that pin and the only people who would really know about that pin were people who worked for Western Electric, and a whole bunch of other stuff to establish that his father is who he was saying his father was. And we did another interview, but in this case, again, this is in falling into that category where I now have files on the father of everything that I needed and asked for. I have files on the son, but the son asked me to call him John Smith and not use his father's real name because the father is still alive. Well, this then extended the story into a description of the father saying that between 59 and 61, he went in an elevator, just like one of these mining shaft elevators, down 700 feet to the base of a pyramid where he worked on what were conduits, and that the goal had to do with the energy that could be transmitted from this pyramid, and saying that it somehow enhanced energy transmission. Now, that went out in my last coast was last Thursday, and since that broadcast, I am now getting some of the most serious descriptions that I have to date from people who have firsthand knowledge about some kind of a large pyramid west of Mount McKinley, if you look on a map. And I have maps at earthfiles.com. Your listeners can read about and look at everything I'm telling you at earthfiles.com. Think of a reporter who files news about the earth. So it is earthfiles.com is my website, and my email address is earthfiles@earthfiles.com. And I have a whole series of reports now with Doug Mutchler, the first contact, with the John Smith character in the second contact. And I'm going to be posting by tomorrow a part three in a second series. This will be my sixth on this story that contains some of the most astonishing supporting material, meaning these guys who approach me, I think, have been telling absolutely what happened in their lives as firsthand. And now I'm getting people who are supporting everything they've said and more. And then, Howard, stand back from this and say, My God, a pyramid larger than Cheops, underground, under the crust, in Alaska, west of Mount McKinley, in some of the most rugged rural area on the planet.
But in a place where it's very hard for most of us to get to and see.
Yes, and who would have had the ability to put it there? And even the John Smith person said that he had talked with his father about whether non-humans had built it, and the father's only reply was, the technology was unknown to all who worked at the site.
What do you think that means? What do you think that means,
Linda? I think it it means that whoever put pyramids all over this planet, which would include Cheops in Egypt, perhaps, that those pyramids that now another area of ridicule by the so-called mainstream media, or we'll say even ignoring, such as the Bosnia pyramids, other areas where there are now claims that there might be pyramids under Antarctic ice, that they, what it seems to be being suggested, and you haven't been exposed yet to the emails that I've been receiving, is that there appears to be a grid of pyramids around this planet, that our government and probably your government caught on to the fact that there was a way to have energy flowing between pyramids, and that that was constructed and used by somebody other than human.
Are you suggesting that the likes of Obama and the likes of David Cameron in the United Kingdom and all the other heads of state are aware of this, but don't talk about it?
I don't think they've ever been briefed.
So this is at a level even beyond them?
Yeah, I think this is part of these, like the Churchill, Eisenhower, they may have known, and there may have been a Majestic 12 that Truman had, but in terms of general passage of the baton about extraterrestrial biological entities having been based and terraforming this planet for millions of years, which I think is the length of time, millions of years, that they, that whatever inside agencies feel that they have hard knowledge about that fact, this is not something that has been passed from, we'll say, the inner, as Bob Wood, if Robert Wood were part of this conversation who worked for McDonnell Douglas, he has become absolutely convinced that Truman had this small coterie of the Majestic 12 group. Some people said they were called the Majority 12 group, and that there was a just like between Prime Minister Churchill and General Eisenhower, as suggested in the MOD release, that they made a decision between the two of them that there would be a policy of denial for 50 years. They may have been two, and maybe there were another 12 in England and 12 in the U.S. that had a need to know. No one else would have a need to know. And that firm grip on need-to-know knowledge is the way that military establishments have generally kept control of information.
There's only one potential problem, though. You had so much response to the first time and the second time you appeared on Coast and talked about this, and you've got this torrent of emails that I'm fully expecting to get to, and I will pass them on to you. If so many people knew about this stuff for so very long, are you really convinced that most of them could have kept their mouths shut so effectively for such a long period? Somebody's always going to talk.
We're not talking about even dozens. I'm saying that the emails that I am getting from people who have, we'll call it a facet of knowledge that supports this story, and that it's firsthand and they can prove it. You can have a facet. That's part of the need to know. Let's say that the whole mystery is a diamond that has 1,000 facets. The diamond is the whole story. One of the facets has a key piece, and maybe 7 people worked on that facet. And maybe over a period of 60 years, if you have 1,000 facets and 7 people in 1,000 facets had that facet and need to know, then you've got 7,000 people, but they do not know what the diamond is. That's the situation on this story, and that there are facets in which people have clearly firsthand hard knowledge.
So these are a bunch of people who've been in touch with you. They have something that perhaps they or their fathers have wondered about all these years, but they've never been quite sure about. Here's their opportunity to tell you, and you can put together the pieces.
That's what I'm hoping.
Linda, this is an amazing story. Where do you think this story is going to go?
Wait till you read the Earth Files. This is not fantasy. fantasy. This is not mythology.
But where's it going to go? The number of times I've heard Richard Hoagland talk about a great discovery on some distant planet, perhaps Mars, and you've thought, this is it, the face on Mars, this is the smoking gun. Okay, that's not analogous with what you're talking about, really. However, the number of times I've heard stories that had the potential to go really huge and international, and those stories, for whatever reason, didn't happen. Are you sure that in this case, this story is going to get the traction that it needs?
I don't know. I'm doing the best I can to keep gathering as much fact and firsthand testimony as I possibly can, and I'm trying to report with focused intent on what number one, what could be buried west of Mount McKinley under the crust in Alaska? Secondly, if the next level of all these implications bear out that there are pyramids all over this planet and that we are in a phase of history in which they seem to be being discovered or reported, whether they're being denied or whether archaeologists are rushing there to uncover, and that Harvard University is willing to step forward and say, yes, yes, my God, there are pyramids all over this planet and a lot of them are underground and we don't know who built them. I would love to see that press conference. But we are at some kind of an archaeological transition here. If you start with just Göbekli Tepe, which I have now been there and been right down in the archaeological pit and have been to the museum and have seen astonishing stone, I'm going to say totem statues and all kinds of things that they have taken out of this amazing site. And if you start in your mind right now and say, we have a 30-acre hill site in southern Turkey, very near the northern Syrian border, covers 30 acres, that Klaus Schmidt from Germany, a well-respected and meticulous archaeologist, started working there in 1994 with no one knowing what was being discovered. And it really was not known until 2010, when he had been working there for a long time, had uncovered only about 5%, remember this, only 5% of this hilltop site has been uncovered. They know about the other 95% because he paid to have deep ground penetrating radar over the hill. And I'll try to summarize and give you a mind's eye picture of what we're talking about. There are approximately 300 19-foot tall, elegant, thin, carved limestone pillars placed in rings or circles, literally all over this hilltop.
300.
Nearly 300. What they have exposed of those 300 in rings, all of them are in repeating rings. What Klaus Schmidt has uncovered, what I was there standing on June 13th with my own eyes and mind, are about 5% of those 300 have been exposed over essentially 94 to 2012, careful, meticulous digging. And as they have dug, he was doing very careful carbon dating, as he could do in layers. And if you are starting at the surface and you have surface soil, and then you're going down at least 19 to 20 to 25 feet in dirt, it's taken a very long time to expose those sections that they have. And as they have gone down, it was only 2 years ago, it was the end of 2009, so that's almost 3 years ago, they discovered a 6-foot-4-inch stone totem. It was completely hidden. No one knew it existed amid all of these rings of standing, elegant pillars. And in some of the pillars, which ties to the construction of the totem and other things that I saw in the museum, imagine this. These are T-shaped limestone. The tops are have, like, think of a T, so that there are these elegant columns that come up, but nobody has glued on the T's. These have all been made out of singular pieces of limestone with these shapes. And what makes it even more astonishing is that several of the pillars already excavated, and who knows what's going to be in the other 95%. Mm-hmm. There is one of these beautiful pillars has a full-blown, like 3 to 4 foot long, cat-like. You can't say that you completely identify the creature, but it is something cat-like with a long tail. And Howard, it is fully blown and formed in three-dimensional form coming out of the side of one of these elegant, thin, beautiful 19-foot-tall T-shaped limestone pillars. And it's not glued on either, this full-dimensional animal. And
no, then we have the ability these days to fabricate stuff like that. But if we think about a civilization... But yeah, exactly. That's what I'm saying. That, you know, to the idea that a previous civilization, us, could do something like that, that stretches credulity. So if we don't believe that we did it, somebody did. And they had knowledge and abilities and techniques that we can't even conceive of right now.
Exactly. And as I stood there with the sun to my back, because we got there for sunrise, and I was standing facing the sun, pure east, on June 13th, and I wanted to know when the sun hit my face, and I turned around with my back then to the sun, what would I see first down inside of the archaeological pits being hit by the first rays of sun? And it was so interesting because it was two specific pillars that stood out, and they are considered to be on a, if you want to put it this way, instead of the thin, it's the broad side of the sculpture, because they're very thin, they're very elegant, but there is width to them because they are T-shaped, and some of them have these creatures coming out, and you could tell that there was definitely a line up of those pillars to something having to do with the sun getting very close to the to June 21st in the summer solstice. Well, when I then moved forward and went down the hill, and that you could get down on wood ramps that will take you right down very close to these excavated pillars, and you're standing there, and I'm staring at the cat coming out of a pillar. I'm staring at animals that are carved that I don't even recognize what they are. And my whole life, I depended upon my gut to give me insights to wherever I've gone, whatever I've been investigating. I was expecting that when I walked down onto those ramps inside of Göbekli Tepe, that I would get an intuitive sense of what is this for? And I got zero. I couldn't get, my mind couldn't absorb a reason for what these rings of pillars were about. And later that day, I did an interview with Robert Schock, PhD geologist, did his PhD work at Yale, now teaches at Boston University, and it was Robert Schock who 20 years ago, I think now, went to Egypt with John Anthony West, because they both were becoming convinced that the Sphinx had water weathering on it, not wind, and that if it had water weathering in terms of the research they had done 20 years ago, it meant that the Sphinx had to be much older than the alleged 4,000, 5,000-year sort of line that was drawn in the sand by academics then, that civilization began 4,000, 5,000 years ago, and that Sumer and Mesopotamia and Egypt were the beginning and all of that. They go, this made the New York Times and the London Times, it was headlines around the world, that geologist Robert Schock stuck his neck out and said, this is definitely water weathering, and the only time that we have been able to research that would make sense that there could have been this much water at this place on the Nile in Egypt. It was 14,000 years old. That was sensational. And they were attacked. They were attacked rigorously by archaeologists saying that this was phantasmagoria. But Robert Schock, geologist with a Yale PhD, stuck to his guns. And where are we now in 2012? There are whole TV programs that are done about the water weathering of the Sphinx, which is Robert Schock's first work. So who am I with in Göbekli Tepe in June of 2012, but none other than that same Robert Schock, who is going because he is convinced that Göbekli Tepe is some kind of a Tibetan bell ringing to anybody who is willing to look and listen, that there was something here on this planet capable of doing that hilltop 12,000 years ago with these astonishing creatures coming out of pillars. And I'm going to tell you about the totem. I have not forgotten, but it leads to something else even more astonishing. Mm-hmm. So I just want you all to kind of grasp with me that the same geologist who was there and was part of the headlines on the Sphinx is now there with us at Göbekli Tepe, and I do an on the record with a videotape and an audio tape running, and I ask him the same context that I had no sense of what Göbekli Tepe is for, and this is what Robert Schock said on the record to me in June. Well, as I look at these T-shaped, thin pillars, he said, what comes into my mind are tuning forks. And he said, I think that there is something about the construction of all of these tall, thin limestone pillars, limestone acting like a crystal, placed in rings all over this hill, that were made to resonate in some kind of frequency or frequency.
So this, and he's not the only person to be saying this at the moment, Michael Tellinger in South Africa is saying something. So this is about the power of sound, that these people understood the power of frequencies and the power of sound.
And it ties to the underground pyramids.
Wow.
Because if we are truly at the bottom of this story, our extraterrestrial intelligences that have used this planet for millions of years, terraformed this planet for whatever were their own reasons, it would have involved a need for them to provide energy for whatever they were doing. And that the true reason for the pyramids to have the hollow centers that they have had, the true reason for stone circles literally all over this planet, including South Africa, that's the work of Michael Tellinger, including something as astonishing as 12,000-year-old Göbekli Tepe and the hypogeum in Malta that resonates at certain frequencies. And that all of, and now brand new work this summer that was reported about Stonehenge, scientists now thinking that Stonehenge could have been constructed in the stone rings the way they were, specifically curved for resonating in certain frequencies. That human society today doesn't even have a paradigm for thinking in terms of resonating stone, crystal, limestone circles, pyramids in frequencies in order to perhaps generate energy. Now, this is a concept that has come up in what I'll call the research that I have done in the animal mutilation phenomena that was tied directly to the presence of extraterrestrial biological entities by sheriffs. It was law enforcement who said to me right from the beginning of my very first interviews in Colorado back in the fall of 1979, 33 years ago, Linda, the perpetrators of animal mutilations are, and this was the term the sheriffs used, creatures from outer space. And why did they say that? Because they themselves had seen beams of light coming down out of ovals or circles of light in the sky, or they had seen these fiery red-orange lights coming up out of the ground. Many law enforcement people, Howard, have seen orange, red lights either come up out of the ground or come out of the sky and go into the ground or split in two and take off in different directions. They're talking about technology that is not Homo sapien technology. It is someone else's. And the sheriffs, the deputies, the ranchers were dealing with that long ago. So now, that led me into this whole strange field of what would non-humans be doing on this planet mutilating animals? That was the first question. Now, 33 years later, I am dealing with archaeological astonishing discoveries that are raising the question over and over, what were non-human intelligences doing on this planet 12,000 years ago and much, much older, terraforming, mining, manipulating, and creating their structures that they knew how to build that would provide energy? That's where this story is headed. Now, let me go to probably the most memorable moment in some ways out of the whole 2 weeks that I was in Turkey, and none of us were prepared for what we saw, including Dr. Robert Schock. At the Göbekli Tepe site, it is 9 miles outside of a town known as Sanlurfa or Urfa, U-R-F-A. And over the period of time that Klaus Schmidt began taking away his first scoops of earth in 1994, and digging down around these remarkable pillars, he started finding very bizarre stone creatures. There's no other way. You're not looking at pieces that you recognize what it is. You just vaguely can say, well, it's definitely in the animal kingdom, but whose? And they decided that they would start taking some of the sculptures that they would find, not coming out of the sides of the pillars. These would be like on, like somehow they had some relationship clearly to, if you saw how Göbekli Tepe once looked upon, say 12,000 years ago, these strange stone creatures would have apparently been dotted all throughout all these repeating rings that had animals coming out of the sides of them, all made and conceived and somehow technologically produced as columns. Well, that whoever was conceiving that was also conceiving these bizarre stone creatures, and they started taking these to a museum in Urfa. Well, while we were there on the 13th, we learned that only 1 week before our arrival, someone had come and stolen a brand new discovered creature, stone creature, from the Göbekli Tepe hillside. And everybody was alarmed and upset, and there was not much security there, and Klaus Schmidt had had to go to Istanbul to talk with the government about the fact that now someone had gone to all the trouble to steal one of these stone creatures that had just been discovered, and that this was reinforcing the need to take all of the loose totems, sculptures to the Urfa Museum.
Otherwise, that site that could end up being so significant, if what we're getting to here is in any way true, otherwise that site will be raped.
Exactly. So now, that afternoon, we go to the Urfa Museum. We have had the astonishing sunrise experience, and none of us were prepared. You enter the Urfa Museum, and the first thing that you pass is what is called Urfa Man. They now have it encased for, thank God, for protection. You are, as a human in 2012, you are looking at something that was created 12,000 years ago, and it is astonishingly modern, meaning you're looking at what appears to be a nearly earless human head. It is done so well that it could be in the Museum of Modern Art in New York today, and no one would give a second thought. It is that sophisticated. and adding to the sophistication of this human head. I haven't gone to the body yet. I will. I'm just starting with the head, because you can't look away from the head when you walk into that museum and you walk around this plastic glass box that it's in, and you can't look away from the head for this reason. The eyes. The eyes are sockets that are like almost perfect circles, not the way a human eye is. These are almost perfect circles. And protruding from these almost perfect circles out at least three-quarters or at a full inch are faceted obsidian. And if anybody has ever seen faceted crystal obsidian, they will know what I'm talking about. The eyes glint with the facets of the crystals protruding out of these circles, this three-quarters to an inch. And the facets begin to draw you in to the point that you can't look away from these strange faceted crystal, pure black eyes.
An amazing description. Who could craft something like that? I mean, obsidian is as black as you can get.
Exactly. And go to Earth Files, my first six. I did a six-part series when I returned. And in the fifth part is all of my story from the IRFA Museum, including my own photographs and my own efforts to try to show this. And as you are totally encapsulated in your mind by these black crystal eyes, you begin to realize that right in between or coming down was once a gigantic nose based on the scar that is in the middle of this perfectly sculpted, incredible head, and someone, something, has knocked the nose off, leaving the scar in the middle of this very sophisticated, sculpted head. And then, right below the scar of what was once this big nose, you realize that your mind is looking for lips, and there are none. There is no scar. This is deliberate. There is no mouth. This is a sculpted, perfect, unbelievable head with suggestions of little ear tips, but there is nothing where a mouth would be. A human mouth is one of the first things we all look at beyond the eyes.
So a representation of what may be an extraterrestrial creature that would communicate not by speech and words like we do, but in another way, perhaps through thought.
That's the first thing that came to my head, Howard, is that I'm looking at the sculpture of a head to which communication was telepathic, because it's either symbolic and metaphoric, that there is only a sunken area in the chin. There's no suggestion of anything that could ever have articulated, or that this was a relationship between the non-human intelligence that made Göbekli Tepe and humans that may have been around, that were used for labor, were communicated with, but only telepathic, and that this was a human that had no ability to articulate voice. And then, but I'm saying that's what came to my mind first, because I kept coming down this unbelievable IRFA man sculpture piece by piece. It's so astonishing. And then my mind is coming back a little bit wider in my mind's eye from this sunken chin that has no mouth to a neck that is going down into a double V neck. There are borders to these V's on what is essentially a leotard. There is no other way to interpret it. But it is a double V. The neck is coming out of a very precise, well-sculpted double V that I have seen in sketches by people in the human abduction syndrome who have encountered non-humans wearing V-necks, leotards, and they have had the same sculpted V or double V on these leotards in non-humans. And here I'm looking at a double V. There's nothing loose on the rest of this body.
So is that a design characteristic or a symbol?
My own sense is that it is a depiction of a uniform that is leotard. That's what my own sense is, but you're raising a very intelligent question. Could it be that this is something that was worn on a leotard or was some, I don't know, but my mind concluded that I'm looking at a double V-necked leotard.
In other words, it could be a Starfleet, I don't want to trivialize this, but a Starfleet uniform. Star Trek style.
Everybody ends up saying, well, did Star Trek copy who was here 12,000 and more years ago? Did Roddenberry?
Well, Gene Roddenberry knew an awful lot, didn't he? He knew an awful lot.
Oh, he was given all kinds of inside information, and the very uniforms that the so-called Star Trek command fleet wore could have been hand given to them by agency insiders saying, and this is what your uniforms will be like, and that all of this was being seeded information without anybody knowing that Star Trek was basically pollinating whole huge generations of humans on this planet to something that our governments knew were true, but they did it through Roddenberry in a TV series, and that one of those we'll call it common denominator links, were the V-necks that were outlined in the Star Trek series, and I'm looking at a 12,000-year-old sculpture that has a double V-neck, but now come down the torso, and I'm leading to the totem, believe it or not, because you have to go to Irfaman first. The arms that appear to also be in leotards, the hands, just like the carved fingers on one of the 19-foot pillars that we saw that morning.
Don't tell me they have six fingers.
Five fingers mm-hmm. in the front mm-hmm. are grasping an erect phallus. The testicles are hanging down below what you would assume were the little fingers of the Urfa man's two hands holding his erect phallus, and the bulges of the testicles are below, and you can see this very clearly in the photograph that is at Earth Files that I took with my own camera. Now, if, as every archaeologist in every article that I have read, including translations from Turkish archaeologists, I've read a lot about Urfa Man through a lot of archaeologists. Every single description is that this is an erect phallus that is being held by the Urfa Man. You are counting five fingers on the outside of the erect phallus. Wouldn't it make logical sense that on the other side, the implication is that the Urfa Man is holding the three-dimensional erect phallus with thumbs that you cannot see? If that's true, and that comes up as a question in the pillars and other things, this Urfa Man had six fingers, five on the outside, and an implied thumb on the other side of the erect phallus.
How staggering.
Otherwise,
you must be so excited by this material. I can hear it in your voice.
Well, but where are we headed with this, which is coming up to the stone totem? So you would expect, with all the details that I have described to you of this extraordinary sculpture of this Urfa Man, that it would go to legs and feet. And instead, below the sculpture of the erect phallus, the well-defined fingers, arms, everything else, there is a peg. The peg is approximately 2 to 2.5 feet long. There's no legs and there are no feet. It is as if this whole thing was designed to be buried at least up to the phallus in the ground for reasons unknown, because the sculpture itself begs to have legs and feet, and it has only a peg. Now, you leave this extraordinary Urfa Man with a focus on phallus. You think of phallic cults, you think of the idea of sperm and egg, the evolution of life. You walk further into the museum, everything is from the site, the Göbekli Tepe site. You're looking at weird creatures. You're looking at things you do not recognize, all sculpted in stone. And then you come to an area where there is the 6-foot-4-inch totem that was only discovered about 2¾ years ago, was not brought out of the hillside until 1 year ago into the museum. And the way I came into this room, I was coming into it from profile. When you go to earthfiles.com, you will see my first angle, my first photograph. And I took that photograph because what hit me was that it looked like I was looking at a, I don't think monster is quite fair, let's just say an unrecognizable animal's head at the top and what looked like reptiles, snakes, the heads and bodies of snakes coming down, two of them, to the ground from the side with this unidentified creature's head at the top. That's when I took that photograph. Then I went in closer, and I took closer photographs of what I thought were the snake heads. And then I came around full front to the totem. And I was so astonished that transforming before my very eyes the trickery of this sophisticated, intelligent, mind-blowing sculpture. When you moved just to the front, the creature's profile in the front is completely obliterated. The face is completely and totally cracked off or erased. But the very next part of the what we'll call right below, what I thought was a creature's head from the side, is another creature. And it definitely looks like a bizarre creature. But what was the snake head and the body from the side is now on both sides, are the shoulders of the bizarre creature below the obliterated face, and the snake from the side are the arms coming around to, again, fingers. And what are the fingers and the arms that look like snakes from the side and shoulders and arms and fingers from the front? What are they coming down to? They are coming down to the pubic region of this bizarre creature. And what is coming from the pubic region? A human child being born.
So right in front of you is a narrative, isn't it? I mean, that is a narrative of us being seeded, being developed, being influenced by something else.
And what popped into my head standing there in shock was the briefing paper, allegedly for the President of the United States of America, that the AFOSI, the Air Force Office of Special Investigations agent, on April 9th, 1983, showed to me at the AFOSI office at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque in a meeting that had been prepared for me by Peter Gersten, the attorney representing Citizens Against UFO Secrecy in New York. And I was there only because I had signed the contract with Home Box Office to produce an hour special for Home Box Office called UFOs, the ET Factor, because the documentary department at HBO had me in New York on March 21st, about 3 weeks before this meeting in Kirtland, where I signed a contract to produce this hour for HBO. They wanted me to go beyond my A Strange Harvest work on animal mutilations that law enforcement themselves in my documentary tied to creatures from outer space. They wanted me to produce an hour that would tentatively be titled UFOs, the ET Factor, going beyond animal mutilations. And this meeting had been set up for me at Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque by attorney Peter Gerson with the AFOSI agent who said he was going to give me names, addresses, phone numbers of witnesses to a landing of a craft in South Dakota and military involvement and all of that. I thought I would be there just to get names and addresses, leave, and work with Peter Gerson on a story. And instead, I was handed this alleged briefing paper for the President of the United States, approximately a dozen pages long, and it went into the history of our government's projects trying to top secret, need to know only, trying to investigate the presence of unidentified aerial craft, known as UACs, unidentified aerial vehicles, known as UAVs, and UFOBs, unidentified flying objects. When you look at historic documents from the Truman administration, you will find UFOBS, which was separating it from the popular UFOs in the press. So you had UFOBs, UFACs, and UFOBS, I guess, and that this went to a page about our government's retrievals of unidentified aerial craft or vehicles from more than half a dozen locations, summarized them, gave dates. And then there came a paragraph that I have never, ever forgotten. Remember it, it etched in my brain. These extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapiens. And later in the paper it said, all questions and mysteries about the evolution of Homo sapien on this planet have been answered and this project is closed. Hmm. Now, I was being exposed at an AFOSI office inside the grounds of Kirtland Air Force Base. That is the center of weapons development and testing for the United States of America, is Kirtland Air Force Base, always has been, and is to this day. And I am being shown a paper that said on the cover, without a date and no agency, but it said on the cover, briefing paper for the President of the United States of America on the subject of unidentified aerial craft.
So you must believe after that that you are being used as a conduit for this information to get out. I mean, you are the channel,
well,
aren't you? You must
be. Remember, I was there as a TV producer working under contract for Home Box Office. That's why.
And somebody decided that they were going to take that a stage further and they were going to give you something more.
Well,
much more.
The odd thing is that the government worked overtime to prevent me from doing that HBO project, and that what, and I think it is an insight. What happened to me on the HBO project, I think, is an insight to the huge argument that has been going on inside of this government of the United States, probably since, I'm going to say, at least the early 60s or late 60s, in which there are factions who say everyone should know what we know, and other factions that constantly win out, no one is to know anything for another two generations, and they keep extending the two generations out. And that they, I think, expected that I would do something independently with what I had been exposed to, and yet every intuitive fiber inside Linda Moulton Howe was, unless you can get formal confirmation from somebody in this government, that's what HBO felt as well, you can't do anything with this material. Otherwise, you become like a shill. Anybody who runs with material that they don't have some kind of backing. The Alaska story is an example where I've not reported anything where it's not been somebody's firsthand testimony.
So you had that great journalistic instinct just in case you were being set up for a fall by somebody.
That's right. And for two solid years, through HBO backing away and saying, unless we, and the head of HBO, I ended up having to go back to New York for yet another meeting because I said, here's what I've been exposed to. This is what they say that I'm going to be able to cover, which was to include actual footage of discs landing at Holloman Air Force Base, the famous story that Robert Emenegger also apparently was exposed to the same information I was exposed to. And when I had that meeting in New York, two or three weeks after being exposed to this alleged formal briefing paper for a president, and I laid out everything that I knew to the HBO now highest executives, the one woman, Bridget Potter, who was second in command to Michael Fuchs back then in 1983, this clearly scared her. The subject matter scared her. It was very clear. She was scared of animal mutilations. She was scared of human abductions. And now she has a TV producer who has won Emmys and a National Peabody and all of this sitting in front of her who is saying that I've been exposed to a presidential briefing paper that says extraterrestrial biological entities manipulated DNA and already evolving primates to create Homo sapiens. Because I told them everything. And she said, unless you can bring to me, and she was the one who had to sign off on the documentary project, and this was a quote, unless you can bring to me the President of the United States, the Vice President of the United States, the Secretary of Defense, and the commanders-in-chief in the Pentagon.
We're not going to do it.
I will not go forward with this project. And when I said, well, then what do you want me to do? She said, proceed and see if you can get me any of those people.
That is fantastic.
For the entire rest of the year of 1983, started living a truly double life. I kept going as far as I could go with leads and leaks, and Gene Abinader, who was the director of Home Box Office underneath Bridget Potter and Michael Fuchs, she said, Linda, if you can come to me with anything, any proof, anything that we can take to Bridget Potter and say, we have this, we've got this person in the government who will stand up and say this much is true. She said, I want to do this. She was my cheerleader. She wanted to do this project. But what happened that there were potential possibilities of my being able, even backlighted, to interview somebody who had firsthand, up close interaction with one of the non-humans. That's what I'm just telling you is true. But I was going to have to do it in a very 60 minutes, when 60 minutes occasionally has done backlighted material to get, say, a squeals on a money scandal. I was going to try to do the same thing on this. Even those began to disappear as if the fix were in. They had exposed X amount of information the way they did at Kirtland Air Force Base. I think they hoped that I would run with it. What? Me standing in front of a camera and saying, here's what happened to me, therefore there are extraterrestrials. But no. A reporter cannot do that.
You were smarter than that, so you outpaced them.
You have to go to find somebody who's willing, in some capacity, even backlighted, to support what you've been exposed to, right? So for 2 years, nobody heard anything from me about any of that. And eventually, I wrote that book, An Alien Harvest, that came out in 1989, my very first book. It has every single thing in it that happened to me, and how and why. And it's a very important, I think, history book, and it includes tremendous amounts of my investigation and forensic evidence on the animal mutilations, including eyewitnesses and ranchers and deputies and others who were tying what they were experiencing out in rural lands directly to beams of light, red-orange spheres of light, to all all kinds of things that fell into the category of the non-human phenomenon.
And Linda, our time on this fascinating conversation is running out, unfortunately, because my webmaster puts limits on how much that I can put up there, and I think we're reaching those limits. However, it seems to me, having talked to you very, very many times, you are very close to the culmination of a life's work. Maybe. Is that so?
I know. Well, you know, Howard, all of us have wondered, will we be alive when the government, when the government stand up to those thousand microphones? Excuse me, it's allergy season here. Various all kinds of things that I'm allergic to are beginning to sprout. But when all of us have this dream, this fantasy, I've always, we're finally, the governments will stand up, tell the human family the truth. We're not alone in the universe. We never have been. This planet has been terraformed by other intelligences for millions of years. We just happen to be the latest intelligent life form that they manipulated into consciousness. We say the Earth is ours. It may not be. But, ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing that we have seen or experienced that would give us concern that we are dealing with anything that means to hurt us or harm the Earth. And it is about time that everybody is introduced to. Now, that's the question. Which ones, under what circumstances, would the non-humans be part of this press conference? Would they finally introduce someone? This has got to be the huge, huge stumbling block. How do any sitting politicians in any generation tell the truth about something that they are worried about will upend religions and so forth? And I stand back from that and say, it's time that the entire planet was told the truth, let the chips fall where they may, because when you realize that we are living on a planet that has been sculpted by lies, kept in, and I don't mean just since World War II. I'm talking about all the alleged secret societies over, let's say, at least the last 5,000 years that have kept control of this planet, control of the barter system, all the money systems, the power systems, because they have had either secret knowledge and maybe even secret allyship with one or more of, we'll call them the terraforming intelligences, for reasons unknown, that have chosen to continue to have some kind of input and control and manipulation on our planet while they are off somewhere else, or they have emissaries here that we're completely unaware. Either way, when we are finally told the truth, whenever that might be, the entire history of this planet and our solar system, I believe, will be so different from what we have been taught.
And Linda, we only have seconds now, but I have to ask you.
We're owed that. We're owed truth.
We are owed truth. I think, you know, nobody listening to this, I doubt anybody would disagree with that statement. Do you believe the things that you discovered in Turkey and what you're learning about Alaska, do you believe that this material has come out through happenstance, just through research, or because somebody somewhere meant this to get out at this point in time?
It's an excellent question, Howard, and I wish I could give you a reporter's answer that had facts to back it up. The only thing I know is this. A huge question is now in my personal reporter's mind. Who had the ability to cover up all of these sites around this planet
for so long,
such methodical ways, because it couldn't have happened just by ice ages and dust.
And that is a whole separate story. There's a conspiracy linked to that potentially. Linda, this is amazing. Your enthusiasm for the subject always communicates itself to me. I can hear the excitement in your voice. Please stay in touch with me and the unexplained, Linda, because I want to put you on here again. Thank you very much. I've let you talk here. We've just done the longest edition of the unexplained we've ever done, and I make no apologies whatsoever for that. And
Thank you. May we all be curious about our planet and our place in this solar system and universe.
And let's hope we both live long enough for some resolution to this particular drama to present itself, Linda. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Thank you, Howard, very much.
Linda, thank you very much. The great Linda Moulton Howe, her website, earthfiles.com, and you can get a link to that website through my website, www.theunexplained. This has been a special edition of The Unexplained with Linda Moulton Howe in New Mexico. Thank you to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for devising the website, getting the show out to you, and above all, thank you to you for being part of this show, The Unexplained. I couldn't do it without you. My name is Howard Hughes. I'll be back soon with another edition of The Unexplained.